Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A guy we've been wanting to talk to for a long time. It's Armstrong and Getty, extra large.
Because 4 hours simply isn't enough. This is Armstrong and Getty, extra large.
You know him, you love him. Steve Hilton hosts The Next Revolution with Steve Hilton on Fox News. He has a brand new podcast we're going to tell you about. His shirts have no collars, and he joins us now. Steve, how are you?
I'm great. I'm wearing a T-shirt just for you. So no,
that's how I was picturing you. Hey, we had somebody wanted to play you from another cable news channel and then discuss a little bit. This was on Morning Joe on MSNBC this morning.
The retail pharmacy giant Walgreens is set to close 5 stores in San Francisco due to rampant shoplifting and organized retail crime.
It's insane. Like, Eddie,
well, it also makes me feel bad that things are so bad for people that they have that this is happening. It's incredibly sad.
No, it's not incredibly sad. They're criminals.
Yes, it is.
No. This has been happening for some time.
But we also want to be open and charitable and mindful that folk are out here hurting, even as 90-year-old men are flying into space.
So Steve Hilton's new podcast is California Rebel Base. And Steve, when you hear that sort of commentary from Mika Brzezinski, that people are just thieving stores to the point that the chains are closing because they're in need. Do you have any comment?
It's just insane, isn't it? It's just so typical of the lunacy that seems to have taken over the way government works or doesn't work in California and all the cities, and the lunacy with which people comment on it and don't understand what's going on. What you've got going on up and down the state is a bunch of people in charge who are literally pro-criminal. The people running the criminal justice, they are on the side of the criminals. They are against actually doing what the first responsibility of government is, which is to basically keep things safe, protect law and order, make it possible for people to do business. But now it's, oh, we have to understand that the criminals need to loot Walgreens, otherwise how are they going to eat? By the way, in a state where they spend so much on welfare and they take so much money in tax and waste it on all these services, and another part of their plan, they keep going on about the billions that they're spending on homelessness. Obviously, that isn't enough because you've got the homeless people robbing the store. I mean, it's just lunacy, all of it. And basically, this is what you get when you have a one-party rule, when you have a bunch of people in charge with no political challenge. There's no accountability, no one standing up to them. They think they can get away with anything. So you get, then they can, because that's what's been happening. And then they let the criminals get away with anything. I mean, this is why people are so angry. This is actually why I started the podcast, which is
called California Rebel Base. And the reason for their name is that actually, I think up and down the state, there are millions and millions of people fed up with this, rebels against this one-party rule. But they don't know what to do about it, because wherever you turn, the crazy people are in charge. We've got to fight back against it, and we've got to have a kind of really concerted effort. We've got to get together, and we've got to stick with it for the long term, not just a quick thing with a recall or whatever. We've got to really go for it, because you can't go on like this in such a state that is one thing. We love California. I love California. I live here. I live in the Bay Area. I'm in the middle of all this madness. But, you know, we've got to fight back.
I can tell by your Valley Girl accent. So what I've been trying to figure out, though, is, like, does the president or the California legislature, do they actually believe this nonsense, or are they just playing to the Twitter crowd, thinking that the Twitter crowd is much bigger than it actually is? I mean, because I find it so hard to believe that there are grown-ups that think, yeah, the people robbing the Walgreens are just, you know, they're struggling because of the COVID, and they're out of work.
Well, and because of systemic racism and the patriarchy.
Yeah, and all the homeless people. Okay, it's just because of the bad economy.
So let's try and be charitable, okay? And let's try and assume good intent on their part and try and understand what's really going on. That's underlying your question, which is they can't just be crazy. Obviously, the policies are crazy and the outcomes are crazy, but these people are not literally lunatics
right.
in charge. Okay, what is going on? What are they trying to do? I think the heart of it is that they've become completely kind of... There's two things, actually. There's the woke ideology, and that is absolutely infecting what you see happening in the schools with the curriculum and a bunch of other stuff, where we see that woke ideology. I've traced the origins of it back on my show on Fox News. It goes back 100 years. This didn't just show up with AOC and her Twitter account. That kind of way of thinking about the world that is all about these kind of categories of identity, that's been going on for a long time. And it originated back in the day in Europe with this Marxist school of philosophers, the Frankfurt School, who were asking themselves the question, why did the communist revolution that Marx and Engels predicted would take over the world and the workers would rise up and capitalism would be abolished? It didn't really happen. And in Russia, they did it with force, but it didn't really take off anywhere else. Why was that? And their answer was, actually, it's not just about economics, as Marx argued. There are other things that keep the working class oppressed. And the three that they focused on were faith, family, and culture. And they said, those are the things that give the working people this kind of false consciousness that they should carry on with capitalism. So we have to undermine those things. We have to attack faith and religion and organized religion. We have to undermine family, because the family unit is what keeps people attached to this oppressive working, oppressive capitalist system. And we have to seize the levers of power in culture and make sure that that's under the control of our ideology as well. That's what they all formulated back in the 1920s in Frankfurt. And over the last century, that's been pushed forward, and you can see the fruits of that absolutely applied today. So there's an ideology at work that says, actually, we do want to undermine family and religion and so on, and you can see that being played out. There's another part of it, though. The second part of it, I would say, again, trying to be fair to these Democrats, is that they are so consumed by the desire to appear compassionate and be kind to people and have compassion for people who are suffering, that they totally forget that real compassion also includes an element of discipline. And you can't just give people things and not expect anything in return, and not demand anything in return and expect a decent outcome. And so they just think it's all about being compassionate and kind and virtue signals. Oh, we love, you know, we don't want to offend anyone. And it's those two things going together that produce these insane policies.
Right. Well, as I've said many times, order without compassion is fascism, but compassion without order is chaos and the dissolution of society. And that's what we're seeing. You know, just to dovetail to that thought, we at the Armstrong and Getty Show, we have never spent a lot of time talking about the Koch brothers, boogity boogity, and George Soros, boogity boogity, because those aren't arguments. That's not a policy argument. It's just citing a boogeyman. But it is worth observing that George Soros and types like him, who are very smart, hardcore far-left ideologues are very, very good at manipulating well-meaning left-leaning voters and people to the extent that they get a Chaso Boudin elected as the DA in the San Francisco area, or what's his face in L.A.?
George Gascon.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. These people are hardcore Marxists, but there's nothing in the Karl Marx or the modified Marx point of view that you were describing that says we must at all times be perfectly honest about what we're trying to accomplish. No, quite the contrary. They're open with each other about we have got to dupe the well-meaning suburban bourgeoisie into going along with our plans.
That's exactly right. And they know that they can do that because that's not who they're going to for their votes. And as you say, they're funded by people with unlimited amounts of money who don't live in those places. They don't have to experience any of this. This is what is so enraging about all of this. If you look at someone like George Soros, for example, you know, we talked about it on my podcast, you know, the other week. Like, he lives in probably in some mansion somewhere. He doesn't actually encounter the consequences of this this pro-criminal ideology that he is funding. And that's what's so offensive about it, actually. The people who suffer most, and this is true of most of this lunacy you see being pushed by the Democrats in California, the people who suffer the most are the exact same people that they say they are standing up for. The poorest, the most vulnerable, people who are recent immigrants, black people and Latinos and Asian Americans. These are the people who actually end up having to suffer the worst public schools, the worst impact from crime. And that's what I find so offensive about it. And that's why, you know, it's time we said that clearly, and don't let them paint people who reject these policies as people who somehow uncaring or cruel or not interested in social justice. It's the exact opposite. They're the ones who are cruel because it's their policies who hurt the most vulnerable.
Been enjoying your commentary for a while. I think first became aware of you whenever you'd be a guest on the panel on Bret Baier's show. But how did you come to your political beliefs? Do you have any sense of why you're this direction as opposed to the other direction?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I grew up in the UK. My parents are both Hungarian. My stepfather's also Hungarian. So that's my family background. And obviously, you know, most of my family still is back in Hungary, which obviously no longer has to suffer the oppression of the communist regime. But I certainly grew up aware of that and traveling to Hungary and seeing my family and just being told that. I remember as a kid, it's a weird memory that sticks in your mind. I'm running around on the street. I didn't really know what I was doing with my two cousins. And as a kind of joke, as a young kid, I remember yelling on the street the name of the Janos Kádár was the communist leader of Hungary at that point. It was the sort of softer end of the communist spectrum. It wasn't as bad as you got in some other countries, but you know, it's still pretty bad. And the name of this leader, I yelled it out and said, "Oh, he's an idiot. And I remember so clearly my cousins saying, "Oh, don't say that." And then I got back home and my aunt gave me this stern lecture about how you can't say things like that. Your cousins will get in trouble. We'll be punished as a family. It was really interesting. I didn't know anything back in those days about obviously these concepts we talk about now, like cancel culture or whatever, but it stuck in my mind as this kind of absence of freedom. You couldn't just say what you wanted. I think the other really formative thing in my life was the fact that my stepfather was, you know, he ran a small business. He was in construction. He did house repairs and built small houses and so on. I spent a lot of time with him on construction sites. You know, we grew up in a kind of, you know, we weren't poor, but it was kind of a sort of classic kind of middle-class family. And that idea of working hard and doing an honest day's work and literally, you know, working that kind of blue-collar job that so many people depend on, I think that really stuck with me. And for example, when I was lucky enough to get to Oxford University, but before I went there, I took a year out and I actually worked for a construction company in London and learned skills as a project manager and so on. But I think that whole notion of really understanding that kind of basic hard work mindset, I think those two things, the Hungarian background and then that culture of, you know, like working hard and climbing the ladder of opportunity, that in which I've been able to do. I feel so lucky and privileged to be able to have done that myself. And now you just see it being taken away for so many other people by these
terrible policies. I think that's where it comes from.
We talk a fair amount about whether it's possible to roll back some of the policies and entitlements that are growing. You were director of strategy for British Prime Minister David Cameron for a handful of years. And it's so difficult to get an honest, even-handed account of Britain's journey through post-war socialist growth of those programs. And then the Margaret Thatcher era. Of course, you know, all of the media and the pop stars and all portray her as far worse than the Wicked Witch of the West. Just an oppressive, evil person who is, to my mind, just trying to recapture Great Britain's greatness and agility as opposed to a giant bloated welfare state. Growing up, how did you see that rise and fall? What's your honest assessment of the Thatcher years?
Oh, I mean, I couldn't be more. I mean, I was so proud that I actually got to meet her and work in the for a while. I was had a junior researcher job in the Conservative Party when she was Prime Minister. No, I mean, and I actually growing up, that was part of that whole story for me, because I remember, you know, I guess I absorbed this at the kind of kitchen table or whatever. You know, my stepfather, my family. You know, it was very interesting. I mean, again, it's these things you remember, like Thatcher was on our side, because she was for working people. And the Labour Party, the socialist, the equivalent of the Democrats, I remember this phrase that was used all the time in our household, they're for the layabouts, you know, which is a pretty kind of aggressive word and whatever. I probably wouldn't use it now, you know, but that's...
I got a bunch of people I'm going to call layabouts for the rest of my life now.
The layabouts, maybe that's, the layabouts. So, look, she saved the country. There's no question about that. And stopped what was looking like a really terminal decline for Britain, and it was focused on two things, which is getting the government. I mean, it's an insane level of centralization of government power, where the government owned and ran pretty much everything in the country. I mean, you know, the airline, the railways, the phone company, all the utilities, energy, everything. It was owned by the government and run by the government and delivered with no competition, no private sector investment, and everything was falling apart. And so the great innovation was the privatization program, to take those assets, put them back in the public sector, sell them to the people so people could become shareholders and get invested in the success of the economy. It's an incredible transformation. The second part was the union reform, the trade union reform. And you couldn't do anything in the UK without the permission of the unions, not just the government unions, but unions in the private sector as well. So she enabled people who started and run businesses, as I have. You know, I've been an entrepreneur in the UK and here in California, and, you know, like that, just that freedom to start your business and employ people and find a customer and find customers for your product or service, and that whole enterprise culture is what she created and revived the economy and society in the process. So she was a complete savior for the country, as far as I'm concerned. That's not to say everything she said or did was perfect, but overwhelmingly, she saved the country. I think that's the simplest way of putting it.
Enterprise culture, that's interesting. Because, again, back to where do we get our worldviews, and I don't even know where I got mine, really, but back when I was starting out in, after college or whatever, and struggling like so many people do, and I had three jobs and I was broke and I was sleeping on the floor in this sublet apartment because I didn't have a bed. I mean, I didn't, but yeah. it never crossed my mind that there should be some government program or something.
Correct.
It never occurred to me. And so we've
got
that this,
you were somehow being cheated.
Yeah. I just thought I've made some bad decisions, which I had, and I needed to make some better ones or get a better job. And so we got this $5 trillion worth of programs staring us in the face here in a couple of weeks. And how do you get people out of the mindset that it's the government's got to fix my current woes as opposed to me? I don't even know how you do it.
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. I mean, first of all, this is something that maybe isn't such a comfortable conversation for conservatives or people on the right to have, but it's important we have it. Why is there such an appetite for this far left lunacy, as we could characterize it? Why is it even being discussed? Why is it so the norm, actually, for a lot of younger people to say, yeah, of course we need this. Of course we need the government to help me with, you know, buying a house or rent or whatever it may be, and every aspect of my life to be subsidized and supported by the government. One of the reasons for that is that they look around and their experience of the free market
free enterprise capitalist system over the last couple of the last decade or so has not been very positive. And they said, well, hang on a second, why should I buy into the market approach? Because the market approach means that there's absolutely no chance I'll ever earn enough or be able to save enough to own my own home. That's completely out of reach. Most of these jobs that you look at, you know, they don't pay enough to live on with all the taxes and whatever. And so they look at what's been going on and they say, actually, there's no opportunity. That's all just BS, this idea that if you work hard, you get on and so on. And that also feeds into these terrible social trends, like people thinking, I can't afford to have kids, so what's the point of actually thinking about starting a family, because it's never going to be possible. So we got to acknowledge that actually there are things that have gone wrong with the way capitalism has worked. And this is actually one of the things I argue in my book, Positive Populism, was actually there is something to that populist critique. And we got to do something about the fact that a lot of the rewards in the free enterprise system have gone to people at the top, which I don't begrudge for a second. As you know, if you start a business and you and people love it and want to buy your stuff, then great. You're meeting a need. That's fantastic, and you should get rich in the process as an incentive. No problem with that. But we need to actually look at the policies that, for example, have made housing so unaffordable that people look at that and think, I'll never be able to afford a house. You've got to do something about that. However, the answer to a lot of these points is not to go in the kind of government control left-wing direction, but actually more in the opening things up direction. And the kind of phrase that comes to my mind, because I talk about it all the time, is what to me the populist thing is all about, is putting power in people's hands. And that means taking it away from the government to centralize and control and regulate everything. And a good example in relation to housing is actually the way you deal with the problem of affordable housing is not to give people more money so that you're subsidizing it, but actually to reduce the amount of regulation that makes it so expensive to build a house in the first place, and to get rid of some of these zoning regulations that mean that it's impossible to create enough housing to meet the demand. So the answers will often be more conservative and libertarian, but we've got to at least acknowledge that, you know, why there's this appetite for this incredible march to the left, and give positive solutions and not just, I mean, I always condemn it as craziness because it is, but you've also got to offer something positive that says, here's our plan to help you earn a decent living and afford a home and so on. Not massive compulsory government centralization and regulation. There's a better way of doing it. I don't think the right has been very good at that. I don't think Republicans have been very good at that. They haven't been offering solutions, and we need to get into that business as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think the right has been very lazy about advocating for liberty. We've just assumed for many generations that people understand it and value it.
Bunch of layabouts.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, Steve, I was actually going to bring up a different book of yours, More Human, from back in 2015-ish, something like that.
Yeah, sorry,
but I know you're pretty critical about certain aspects of capitalism. We've often made the point on our show that there are a lot of aspects of capitalism that people point to and say, this is bad, this is ugly, that are the opposite of the free market. They're crony capitalism. They're giant corporations which write the very laws which pave the way for them to become dominant and ugly and abusive.
Exactly. I call them, I can't remember now, but kind of private sector bureaucracies. That's what they are. They're like government bureaucracies. They happen to be in the private sector. And they're very cozy with the people who make the laws. And in fact, you know, that's why I've been so focused on the corruption that we see in our system, because actually you literally have, particularly at the state level where there's less scrutiny, you have the businesses who buy up the legislature. They give that. You don't need to give that much money. Actually, a state legislator doesn't require that much money for their campaigns. You know, it's pretty cheap to buy them up, and then you get in the room with them, and you literally send around what they call model legislation, and then they implement it. But of course, we can't be one-sided about this. I mean, particularly in California, I mean, that's also happening from. And the left never talk about this. They love attacking the Koch brothers and big business and dirty, you know, dark money in politics and all this stuff. But they never talk about the fact that you've got exactly the same going on with the government unions.
Oh, they own the state.
System is such a disaster. They own the state because of the government unions. That's no different. All of it is corrupt. That's why, coming back to what I've argued, you know, you put power in people's hands. So you get rid of all this corruption and cronyism, wherever it comes from, whether that comes from big business or from the big unions, because no one should have too much power. It's the concentration of power. That's the argument I made in More Human and positive populism. When you have too much power in too few hands, that's when you get problems, whether that's in the economy or with government and politics. You've got to take the power away and put it in people's hands. And that's the thing I've always, I just want to make this point that I think is really important for people who hear the word populist. And you see commentators constantly say, well, you've got left-wing populism and right-wing populism, and you've got, you know, the kind of Trumpy right-wing populism, and then you've got Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and AOC, and they're populists of the left. I don't think you can be a populist on the left, because what they're all about is taking power out of people's hands and putting it in the government's hands and centralizing power there. And actually the most incoherent on this is Elizabeth Warren, who actually, I think, makes a pretty good case about how there's too much monopoly power in the private sector. We've got to break up big tech and so on. I agree with her about that. But in the same breath, she goes on about centralizing power in the public sector,
right,
and having the federal government in Washington start controlling everything, childcare and family policy and housing and you name it. So she's all for breaking up power in the private sector, and I'm with her on that. But in the public sector, she wants to centralize power. And I think we should be consistent and say we want to put power in people's hands right across the board.
Steve Hilton's podcast is California Rebel Base. Steve, you've been generous with your time talking to a couple of guys. We couldn't get into Oxford unless we were there to clean the toilets. So, but really enjoyed the conversation. I hope we can do it again.
Fantastic. It was a great pleasure. See you soon.
It is remarkable the extent to which people who grew up under communism or are the children of people who grew up under communism they're practically 100% conservatives. I think that speaks volumes.
Is there a name for that accent? I mean, we all just call it an English accent, but in America, you know, we've got all kinds of different accents, Northeastern, Southern, Midwest.
I don't know if there's a name for it, but I would describe it as educated London.
Yeah, probably something like that, huh?
I mean, he's not like a Manchester fisherman or anything like that. Right, no, not cop.
What are you doing? Yeah, I'm not a lot of that.
What's all this then? No.
Extra large.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.